With the sermon today, I do want to mention that it can be a sermon that is quite sensitive. And so as I think about or thought about what to say and what to put down in my notes, just as a reminder of what was going through my mind, that it is a subject where if we start with the wrong thoughts, I guess, or start with certain scriptures or certain scenarios that is, that took place in the Bible, we could have a wrong view of what a Christian should be thinking, because there is a context to what is happening in the world. The sermon, just so you know why it would be good to make sure we start properly and summarize, I guess, or analyze the situation carefully. The title is A Christian's View of the Death of Innocent Lives. A Christian's View of the Death of Innocent Lives. So I'm not going to be giving a prophecy sermon, although we know that this subject deals with what's happening over in the Middle East, of course, and with other situations throughout time where innocent people have died. And speaking of that, there were, I think, from what I looked up, 38 million innocent civilians. We say innocent, we don't know what they were thinking or who they were cheering for, so to speak, but there were 38 million innocent civilians in World War II. 38 million. We do have innocent lives that are being taken right now over in the Gaza Strip and also in Israel. Innocent lives right from the very start. And as I talk about this subject, I want all of us to realize that Israel is not a righteous nation. Israel is not a righteous nation. So when we speak of what's happening over there, we're not going to be picking on anybody. Within the plan of God, there is a reason that this is happening, of course. But Israel is not a righteous nation. The entire world is going to be cursed or blessed based on what they are doing, what they are, what they believe in, plus what they're caught in. Sometimes they're just caught in a situation where they're going to die, and it's not their fault. They didn't choose to be in that situation, and that would be Israelites and Gentiles alike. Another thing I want to mention is that the word Gentile is not a wrong word. It's not a bad word at all. A Gentile just means someone who is not an Israelite. And that means that Abraham would be in the category of a Gentile. Isaac would be in the category of a Gentile. Adam and Eve would be in the category of a Gentile. They were the nations. Basically, a Gentile is just somebody who is not an Israelite. Israelite is someone who is from the line of Jacob. Jacob changed his name. So in all of this, I want us to understand that we're not we're not speaking of righteous people in most of what we're talking about today. We're not talking about righteous people. We're talking about what God planned, but also what people choose to do and the state of what's going on right now over in the Gaza Strip. My question is, and by the way, another thing I should bring out right away is that the Israelites were not chosen because they were the greatest people on earth. They were very stubborn, hard-necked people. And they came out of total paganism, which they were happily involved in. They were. They weren't complaining about the religion in Egypt. They were complaining about the hard work. So I hope all of us do understand that. Yet I want to point out also that Israel was God's chosen people. And promises that God made to Israel were to be forever on this land. Those are promises that were supposed to be during the 6,000-year period. Well, I should forward to the time that there was in Israel. So I have a question here, and that is, why is almost the entire world angry at Israel? Why is almost the entire world angry at Israel? Most of the world, and we're talking about the nations who recognize Israel as a state, the bona fide state, and they're not against it, But most of the world are upset, not at the retaliation against Hamas. They're upset as what has taken place later. They believe that Israel was justified. Most of the world initially believes that the world was justified by attacking Hamas. 14 people were killed. 1,400 people were killed on October the 7th. And there was an almost immediate attack on Hamas. But what the world is against is that it's overkill, I guess we would say, and that would be a word that would apply absolutely, overkill. They don't like that, and this is the nations that believe it was fine for Israel to protect themselves, but there's a time to stop. It's almost like, well, there's a rule of war here, a rule of war, can't use mustard gas, for example, can't use nuclear bombs, but also, if they kill 1,400, then you can only kill 1,400. It's almost like that's how some people think. Now, I'm exaggerating because I think everybody knows that if there's a retaliation, there's going to be more than 1,400 people killed. So what we're looking at is the world overall upset at Israel. Why are you doing this? Now, Netanyahu says, if we don't take care of the terrorists, the world is calling them militants. You know, they're not supposed to call them terrorists. If you don't take care, if we don't take care of the terrorists now, then Europe is going to be next. They're going to have to take care of the terrorists. And also after that, it's going to be America that will be having to take care of the terrorists. And he doesn't know it, but that's prophesied. Maybe he does know it because he reads the Old Testament. I don't know how much attention he pays to the New Testament, but those prophecies are in the Old Testament. So he knows about a king of the north, a king of the south. He knows Jerusalem is to be surrounded, maybe. Luke had to point that out, that you go back to Daniel to figure out when Jerusalem is going to be surrounded, because he says, as you read in the book of Daniel. So Netanyahu understands something about what's going to happen, and he understands that you cannot have territory for peace. What's happened in the past, starting in 1917, I believe, is Israel was promised a territory. And you jump forward, that didn't happen, of course. The British backed down on what they wanted to supposedly fulfill. And then 1937, you have the Arabs and the Israelites told that, look, we'll partition the land this way. The Arabs turned it down. And in all of the partitioning, I think the Israel has accepted it. 1947, you had the same thing that happened. The Arabs turned down the partitioning that I believe was in the hands of the United Nations by that time. The British had turned the mandate over to the UN. And the next year, of course, they tried to annihilate Israel. If you're a Muslim and you really believe in what the Muslims say, you are going to say that the Israelites should not exist at all. That would be what they believe. Now, I don't say all of them believe that, but that is their religion. That is what the leadership, whenever this started, or whatever it came to be in a matter of time, thought. So what we're looking at then is innocent, and I put that in quotes because of what God says happens from the time that you are born to the time you become an adult, and whose parents and grandparents you have makes a lot of difference there. But we have innocent people being killed. The Christian view of death. I have a paper here that is nakedcapitalism.com. Okay, this is where it came from. There's an author there. You can turn to it, but it has to do, were the prophets anti-Semitic, debunking Netanyahu's distorted biblical justifications for genocide? That's what it's on. Now, it's 6 pages long, so you'll forgive me if I go till 7 o'clock. although I'll look down and look up and nobody will be here probably, so. So I'm only going to, in the 6 pages, take a few sentences out of a few paragraphs. The author says, in the Old Testament, kings were being criticized because they did not create an equitable society protecting the poor from economic oppression of debt bondage and loss of their land. Now think of what's happening now in the Gaza Strip and the poor and loss of land. And then he goes on to say that that's violating the most basic laws of biblical Judaism. Later on down, he says, just as its wealthy creditor elite had dispossessed their brethren from the land, so the 10 tribes of Israel were deported to Mesopotamia and Media. So Israel dispossessed people from their land, and here's what God did. He deported them to Mesopotamia, and Judah's size was reduced. So you can see where he's going with this. Netanyahu has evoked what he claims to be a biblical excuse for Israeli genocide. He said he pretends to be a covenant in the tradition of Moses as a vicious demand by the judge in gray eminence, Samuel telling Saul. So now he goes to Samuel telling Saul, look, you've got to get rid of these Amalekites totally. And he said, you know, Samuel was not a Moses. God didn't tell Samuel to do this. This was Samuel's idea. So he says, God was not for this. And he said, Samuel wanted to put his king in power. Well, Samuel didn't want a king. So this guy doesn't know his Bible really, really well. And you look at this, and what I'm bringing out in all of this is a worldview. Maybe without some of the Bible, if people don't know the Bible, they wouldn't be using these justifications for what they say. But overall, this is the world's view that Israel is being too hard on those people, and they don't have the right to completely rid this planet of an entire nation, the Palestinians. So he says, these were not the Lord's own words. Samuel was no Moses. Going on, it says, it was not the Lord offering that command to destroy Amalek. He doesn't know about Amalek either, because God said early on in Exodus, if you don't get rid of the Amalekites, better yet, then they're going to haunt you and they're going to be a thorn in your flesh all the way to the end. So the man doesn't know his Bible very well, but he's trying to justify what he's saying. He said, what was the covenant at Horeb near Mount Sinai? Simply put, the Lord gave Moses the Ten Commandments, which had a moral focus on the Sabbath and idolatry. You know something, in this entire paper, there's nothing about idolatry coming out of the Ten Commandments. There's nothing about the Sabbath. We know that Israel got in trouble basically because of idolatry and Sabbath breaking. This guy brings up economic justice and making a bargain binding all future Jews to obey these commandments, so you just treat the poor and you don't take their land. Does one doubt that today's great Israel, the land over which it exerts totally control, including Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem, is economically polarized and unequal both financially and in terms of human rights? You see how human beings think? So we're looking at this because I thought when I read this, I thought, that's what the world thinks. This is what the world thinks. Then he quotes Isaiah 10, 1 through 3, and those who are oppressing the poor. Ezekiel 7, chapter 7 and 16, also not heeding the poor and needy. Amos 2, denying justice to the oppressed and the poor. And you come down to Malachi 4, where all the arrogant and evil doer will be stubble, thinking that that's applying to the Israelis today because they are evil doers. Now, again, I said that they're not the most righteous people in the world. The Israelites are going to be themselves cursed by God. The curse will come because of their own law breaking. But the man has things a little bit backwards, doesn't he? That's a worldview, though. That is a worldview without necessarily going to Micah 4 and Isaiah and Ezekiel. So what should be the Christian view, okay? I have either 8 or 9 or 10 points. Actually, I have, 8 points. Number one, if we want to see, get God's perspective in this and have a Christian view, we have to first realize that God in heaven is not the God of this world. People think overall that, and I'm sure this would be true, maybe not of nominal Christians, but some nominal Christians might think, if you're a Muslim, you have a spoke leading to the hub, which is nirvana or whatever you call it, afterlife. So there are, 20 spokes of different religions leading into afterlife. So if you think that way, now you are starting to base your decisions and your thinking on a wrong premise. I think we've all heard that before. If you start with a wrong premise, then you're not going to come up with the right conclusions. So if you think that everybody is going to be going to heaven, okay, then it's like, okay, you've got to treat everybody right then. These people all are God's people. And they are, but not yet. Let's put it this way. They're God's creation, but they don't worship the true God. So Satan is the god of this world. 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 4, we can read that as a scripture we know. And I could say, well, we know it so well that I don't have to turn to it, but I think it's good to be reminded that that's the way it is. We could go to 1 John where it says Satan has sway over the whole world. But here in chapter 4 of 2 Corinthians verse 4, we have whose minds the god of this age, that is people out there, the world, whose minds the god of this age has blinded, who do not believe, lest the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine on them, the god of this world. Now, we know all that, but when we look at this question of how we should look at the innocents dying, we have to remember this is not God's world. It is Satan's world, and Satan is allowed to rule so that mostly when people are raised in the second resurrection, they can look back and say, that was not very good at all. And when they live in a world that is governed by Jesus Christ, they can compare. Now, some won't be able to compare because they die too early before they even give much thought. But overall, there will be enough people around those who have not lived in Satan's world that long to tell them that it was not good. This is the best way, the best plan that could have come up. And oftentimes, even in this life, we learn best from our mistakes. We learn not to do something. We learn that it was a horrible thing to do because we did it. And then we don't do it, and we can come. This is the best way. And this is what God has done with all mankind. As we know, there's only a few that are called. So if you have that premise that Satan is the god of this world, then your view, knowing that not every religion is going to get you into salvation, living forever, your view changes a little bit. Okay, secondly, this is not the only day of salvation, naturally. This is not the only day of salvation. When you go to Romans 11, verses 7 through 10, and I might say that there's two thoughts on the worldview. One is that you are going to die. If you don't choose God's way now, you are going to suffer in hellfire and burn there forever. So I think the attitude of the world for those who don't believe that and believe, well, there are many ways. I think that if there's only two things about, the second would be that God is going to be, he is going to allow people who did not know Christ to have salvation. That's a lot better than burning everybody forever. But of course, both are wrong. It's just not the day of salvation. Romans chapter 11 and verse 7 through 10. Romans 11, 7 through 10. Let's read verse 1 first and then go to verse 7. I say then, has God cast away his people? He's talking about those Israelites of old who did not choose Jesus Christ as their Messiah. They rejected Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ was a stumbling stone to them. I say then, has God cast away his people because they did not accept Christ? Certainly not. I'm an Israelite of the seed of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin. So Paul wasn't rejected. And then he goes down to say, what then, in verse 7, Israel has not obtained what it seeks, but the elect have obtained it. And the rest were blinded. The rest were blinded. This is not the only day of salvation. The rest are blinded. Chapter 9, 10, and 11 are really good on the subject of people who have not accepted God's way of life for one reason or the other, being blinded or being called and not accepting that calling right away. But those three chapters are really good to give us an overview of what God is doing. But in the meantime, in verse 8, God has given them a spirit of stupor, eyes that they should not see, ears that they should not hear to this very day. Let their table be a trap, a stumbling block, and a recompense to them. Let their eyes be darkened. And that's the way the world is. So now we have a premise on which we can determine how we as Christians should view innocent lives. Since Satan is a god of this world, and since they're not being called, this is not the only day of salvation, we realize that in this world, there's not going to be justice, there's going to be war, evil will prevail, and mankind will have a chance. They're not being judged today, and because they're in this world, they'll follow the way of Satan the devil, and you will have war between God's people, Israel, they were, and then those who are not God's people. So, based on that premise, what do we do? Well, now we think, well, you know, it's innocent people dying, but we understand why they're dying in this world, because all you're going to have is trouble in Satan's world. You're not going to be blessed overall in Satan's world. Okay, points 3 and 4, I combined these 2 points because, and I could have, you know, started numbering them differently, but I decided we'll just combine points 3 and 4. That God chose a physical nation as his people, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to be his holy physical nation, and gave them land, gave them the promised land. He gave it to them as long as they shall live. And we know that Israel was without a nation for 2,000 years. They had no land. They didn't have the land God gave to them, but God gave them back in 1948. So we have then, with that nation that God made holy, he said, look, you have commandments that you have to keep. And this is a very important point here, points 3 and 4. He gave them commandments. And we can determine by those commandments why there's going to be a division between people that will be blessed and people will be cursed. We can go to a couple scriptures here, basically one, and then I'll just extrapolate on some commandments that God gave. Exodus 19, 3 through 6. Does the world think that Israel owns that land? Does the world think that Israel has that land? It is theirs. And the answer is, well, some will, but others do not. And because the Jews were persecuted so much, millions dying in the Holocaust, a lot of people, for that reason alone, say they deserve a land. They deserve to be in that land. Others will be enemies, the cousins, The uncles, the aunts of the Jews, the Israelites, are going to hate them because Jacob came into that land and took it away from their cousins. And you can talk about Moab, Ammon, the daughters of Lot, I guess we would say, the generation that came from Lot. We could talk about Esau, and we could talk about other nations that came from the loins of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And basically, there's the fight. I know Marion's father said, he wasn't in the church, he said, it's just a family fighting over there. And he was basically right. Not 100%, because you have all those ites who were not related too closely that are fighting against them. I'm talking about Hittites, Jebusites, that'd be Jerusalem, and then the Amorites and the Amalekites, and I think there are four or five other ites that think that Israel should not be there. So we find now then Exodus 19, 3 through 6. Exodus 19, verses 3 through 6. Here's what it says in verse 3. Moses went up to God, who called him from the mountain, saying, thus shall you say to the house of Jacob. Verse 4. Exodus 19. You've seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings. Does that give us an idea of Revelation 3 and how God is going to give us eagle's wings to go to the place of safety? Get your chariots ready, is all I can say. Get your walking ready. Start walking 10 miles a day. The Israelites walked. So those were eagle's wings. And I'm not being serious, by the way. I'm for walking. I promote walking. It's good to walk. But I don't think we're going to have to walk 10 miles a day. I brought you to myself, God says. Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice, keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine. Now, the author of this nakedcapitalism.com link was referring to the covenant that God made with Israel, and he said basically, treat people equally. Equal land, equal pay, doesn't matter. It's almost like they don't have to work. But you have to have economic equality. That was where it was. And you have to take care of the poor and the needy, no matter what, no matter what. If they attack you, you know, pat them on the back of the hand, but you have to help them out. You shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, he goes on to say. Kingdom of priests and a holy nation. You shall be to me a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel. So that's what we have. We believe it. We believe that land was given to them. And we believe when 1948 came along that they were prophesied to take that land. In fact, the prophecy of Jerusalem being surrounded by armies would not have been able to happen unless you have Israel as a nation. It just wouldn't. So all through the period of time where Jerusalem, I think someone said Jerusalem was surrounded by armies 300 or 400 times. Okay. But if you don't have the prophecy with Israel taking over that territory, none of that surroundings, none of those surroundings, even if you knew the Bible, you'd say they don't count. These are not true Christians, and they're the Muslims. It's just a religious war. And you have, what, three basic religions in Jerusalem? Maybe churches, we could say. So we have then giving of the commandments. What was the first commandment? And this is very important when we think of the view that we have towards innocent people dying. First commandment is, I am the God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Okay. You shall have no other gods besides me. So it's pretty specific on which God we are to serve. There's no question in our mind. It's not a few gods. It's the God that brought the children of Israel out of Egypt. That one God, no other God. So what do we get into here? We get into it with commandment number two also. We get into idolatry being the main problem. Idolatry. Not equity, that everybody has to have the same amount of land and the same amount of money. That was not. Now, God did make sure that the poor would get their land back. God had the laws that would work out that after 50 years, you give back that land, because God did not want generation after generation of poverty. He didn't. But you have the one God. And so the other gods don't count at all. Idolatry is going to be the main problem. It is not going to be poverty. Idolatry is going to be the main problem. And then the second commandment, of course, is take a look at the heavens above and the earth beneath and the waters under the sea, and do not make an image that you're going to bow down to of anything you see in those three spheres. You can't do that, because I'm a jealous God. And if you do that, then the iniquities are going to be passed down to the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me. So do you think that the world overall, those other religions, do you think the Muslims hate individuals who are Jews? And the answer, who believe in the God who brought them out of Egypt? And the answer is, you bet. They hate them. Are they idolaters? Are they idolaters? Are they individuals who, if we are attacked, if you are a Jew and you are attacked in the nation of Israel, where you just say, well, you know, they're poor, let's just give them more land, okay? They need territory. God gave us this territory, but we know it wasn't right for him to do that. We want equity. We need to give them land. And the answer is, well, you can see where this leads. So don't make any image. But, of course, I don't know how many images the Muslims have, but the world has those images. All of the ites, I'll call them, had their idols, and they worshiped them. And God was going to get rid of them out of the land. He was going to dispel them from that possession. So you have those two commandments: worship only the true God. Worship only the true God. And now you have a nation that is separate from all the other nations. And we can go to point five here, where we see God commanded Israel to destroy. And this is why I said this is a sensitive subject, because people will say, well, even today you have, with the United States, you have taking over all the territory where you had other nations dwelling here, and people get upset that we actually took out those people. And that's a sensitive subject also. Even in the football world, that is a very sensitive subject, unless you're the Chiefs. But if you have a name of a nation that was dispelled or something close to it, you know, then you've got to change your name to the Commanders or whatever. Cleveland had to change its football team name. So you can see how this just relates, and you have people, if they can't get a territory back, at least they get a football team back. So, and I'm kind of, you know, being a little bit foolish here, but actually, in principle, it's happening today, isn't it? It really is. So you have then the command. Now, what we do with this is we go back to Deuteronomy 12. Let's go there. Deuteronomy chapter 12. And you'll see what God said. And the main purpose in all of this, brethren, the main purpose of neutering the nation that is there or dispossessing those nation is for the purpose of not having idolatry. Because if you leave those nations there, you're going to be affected and you will become an idolatrous nation. And there's a reason God absolutely knew that was going to happen. I'll just say it right now. Acts 7 tells you that in the 40 years in the wilderness, what were the Israelites doing? They were committing idolatry. They were worshiping images, even to the point where it says, I believe in Acts 7, where they were sacrificing their children. If not, then worshiping Molech was a religion where they did. So in Deuteronomy chapter 12, and we know we use that for Christmas, why we don't keep Christmas. But God was telling them there's going to be probably scores of reasons, because there's scores of gods that they're going to come into contact with, and God does not want them having anything to do with those nations. Deuteronomy 12, verses 1 through 4. Statutes and judgments, he says, in the land I'm giving you to possess all the days you live on the earth. You should utterly destroy all the places, so anywhere they worshipped was to be destroyed. Their altars, verse 3. Verse 4, you shall not worship the Lord your God with such things. Again, this is why we don't keep Christmas. We're not going to worship God the way the pagans did. And then you drop down to 29, verse 29, and here it says, when the Lord your God cuts off from before you the nations which you go to dispossess. Now again, the world really doesn't believe that all of that territory belongs to Israel. They say, partition it. And the Israelites have actually allowed that. They would have allowed it. And the same thing would have happened, as is happening in Gaza. With Gaza, the terrorists can hide. And in Syria, they can hide. Is that the Hezbollahs or whatever? And then Syria, I think, is a different group. I think it's out of Iraq or Iran, sorry, where you have these groups. And they are attacking Israel. And they're far enough away in most cases where you can knock down their drones and knock down their missiles. But Gaza, very, very close. How would you like a neighbor where you walk out of the house and they've got a machine gun ready to mow you down? That's basically what it is. And this is why Netanyahu says we're going to make the Gaza Strip a desert. That's why he said that. Because we can't trust the Palestinians setting up their own security. It's just not working. We can do it, go in there and do better. It's a physical nation. They're not a 100% righteous nation. I think only 40% of the Jews actually practice Judaism. Well, the Jewish religion. 40%. And I may be off on that, but I believe there's different Sephardic Jew, is it, I think, who would be a little bit more tight on or serious about their religion. And then there are Jews who only keep the Day of Atonement. We had a tailor over there in Cleveland, Ohio, and they closed, not on Saturdays, they closed on the Day of Atonement. That's the only day. When we went to Kansas City, we had a Jewish tailor. They do make good clothes. Actually, they're the middlemen who find really good clothes at good prices. But this guy, the father kept the Day of Atonement. The son, who took over his business, did not keep the Day of Atonement. And yet, they belong to, supposedly, the very serious Jews. So anyway, again, you don't have a righteous nation. And this is what's happened. You mix a Jewish nation in with a nation that is not keeping the commandments, committing idolatry, and what's going to happen? You're going to be affected. You're going to marry into that religion, and oftentimes it is the nations around Israel who would have affected them. They've got some pretty good-looking gals. Wasn't it with... let's see, I think it was with Balaam who sent some, I think he told Balak to send some really good looking Moabite girls over into camp. So, you know, it's pretty good looking gals there. Not better looking than any of you gals out here, of course, but this is what happened. And what we're talking about is how you get another nation to start committing idolatry, a whole nation to do so. So take heed to yourself that you are not ensnared to follow them after they are destroyed from before you, that you do not inquire after their gods, saying, how did these nations serve their gods? I'm going to do likewise. Don't worship the Lord your God in that way, for every abomination to the Lord which he hates, they've done to their gods. For they burn even their sons and daughters in the fire to their gods. It was because of idolatry that God said, stay away. So what do we have then? Well, God is dispossessing them. He's saying, look, because of how they will affect you, you can't live with them. You have to keep them out of your land. Hey, point number six, God does not destroy nations until they are bad enough. Okay, so we have God saying, you're going to take over a land. How many years from the time God told Abraham to the time they actually took over the promised land, how many years was that? And the answer is 400 to 430 years. Genesis 12 said, look, I'm going to take your seed and you're going to be in bondage in a strange land. After that, that seed is going to be taken into a land that I'll give them for possession, and it's going to be the land of the Amorites. But what did he say about the Amorites at that time? Their sins are not complete enough, is the word it's not the word he used. He used whatever language God has, he used that word, but in Hebrew it was complete. Their sins aren't complete enough. It's going to take 400 years before that tribe and those nations are bad enough where the iniquity of the father is going to be passed down to the kids, the grandkids, and the great-grandkids because I'm going to punish the father or the sins of the fathers upon the kids. It's because the kids are going to become like the parents and grandparents. There's no hope because every generation is going to be wicked. Because God just doesn't take you out because you've got an unrighteous parent. He waits to see what we're going to do. The story of Jonah, and we'll get to that in a moment, shows that God is not quick to take people out. So he told, in Genesis, he told Abraham, it's going to take 400 years. And he uses the term Amorites. In Exodus 33, where you see they've come out of the wilderness, or of Egypt, better yet, they're in the wilderness, God says, the promised land is going to be there over where the Amorites are. And he mentioned a few more nations. That was in Exodus. They were on their way, and it was going to be about 40 years. Eventually, they sinned enough where God didn't give it to them. So 40 years later, God says in Deuteronomy, you're going to go into the land that I'm going to give you, the land of the Amorites. Same nation that was not that wicked. So there is wickedness, there is sin, and then there is sin. And I think all of us know that. We can become impatient, or we can become angry. That is a sin, but I think killing is even worse, okay, than there's sin. And it was that way with the Amorites. They hadn't come to the point where it was complete. Now, 400 years later, the Israelites are about to go into the promised land, and it's the Amorites and all those other pagan nations. Joshua 6, what did God do there? Joshua 6, and you already know, but you'd have to look it up to find out what group this was, but Jericho was an Amorite city. And when he went in there, Joshua 6, verses 1 and 2, they didn't play fair, so to speak. They went to war definitely against the innocent. And they didn't take him out at that time. They didn't take him out during the time of Saul. When David came along, he fought against the Amorites, the Amalekites. they were in the Ite bunch. But God is talking, of course, the Amorites, but the Amalekites would be the same because they were wicked from the very beginning. They were bad enough to be destroyed back in Exodus. And that's the time, remember, when Moses' hands were up in the air and his arms were getting tired. And Joshua had to come along and was the priest, I think, on the other side and hold his arms up. They were battling against the Amalekites, and they didn't destroy the nation back then when they were so wicked. And they've been in the thorn in the side ever since. So we see then that this is the way God did it, so that there would not be idolatry. It wasn't just a hatred of people at all. It was so you wouldn't be involved in a nation where you start worshiping other gods. And if you worship, if you take out the first commandment and the second commandments, guess what else is going to fall besides the Sabbath? It's going to be your treatment of human beings. You're not going to help the poor and the needy. Those were, you know, thou shalt not steal. The opposite side of that, we know from reading Ephesians, is instead of stealing, you give to the poor. You help. You're not going to do that once you get rid of the right God and displace the God with a wrong God. You're not going to keep the last six commandments, nor the third, nor the fourth, nor the second, because now you are putting another God in the place of the God that brought the children of Israel out of Egypt, back to that first commandment. Okay, so what do we have then as far as what God is doing here? We will end with the attributes of God and the way he thinks, what he wants. Jonah went into the land, and I won't turn to that account, but Jonah was told to take a vacation first, take a trip on a ship, take a cruise, and come back, and I have a job for you to do. Well, that's what Jonah thought. God didn't have the cruise in mind, of course. So he tries to escape. He goes as far away as he can. And God, of course, has him swallowed by a great fish. And I think it's on the shore of the Black Sea, is it, where he's vomited up. And probably they thought he's a god, that the fish god has sent a prophet. However, I've heard that as a possibility. You don't read that. But Nineveh was a major enemy of Israel. They were a wicked city. And God says, tell Nineveh that I'm going to destroy them in, 40 days was it? Big city he was walking through. And Jonah went around and then went up on the side of the hill under a plant that had grown that was giving him shade and waited for God to destroy the nation. And God said, you know, Jonah, they're fasting. They won't even let the animals eat. And the king is called a fast, and they are humbling themselves. I'm not going to destroy them. And Jonah said, I knew you were going to do that. Could have told you so. I knew I was wasting my time on this trip, is what he said. And at the same time, Jonah had this plant that was dying in the sun, we'll say. And God said, look, you are more concerned, and this is a big lesson for us when it comes to major enemies, people that you don't like, they don't like you, first of all, you don't like them, they are your enemy. And God says, it's kind of like Ahab, remember when Ahab fasted? And God says, oh, that poor man. And the Elijah would say, God, you got to be kidding. You mean you're not going to kill him? God says, well, I feel sorry for him. We better let him live. And the same thing happened with Nineveh. You know, I feel sorry for that nation. And Jonah said, I don't. They should die. And Jonah said, look, we got all these thousands of children who do not know their right hand from their left hand. Now, some say spiritually. I don't. I think literally there were the little kids, and God says, no, it's not the time. I am not going to take them out. So we've got to be like God and not like Jonah. So what else is God like? Let's go to a few scriptures here. Ezekiel 18:23, and we now know why we have a view to know, not necessarily to feel that, oh, this is great what God is doing through Israel. We're not doing that. We feel like I hope God does. We know, though, what is happening and why it's happening in the world. That's what we know. We have that knowledge. And we know that these people are going to be in the second resurrection, and we don't like the idea that they're suffering. We don't like that idea. So let's see if that's the way God feels. Ezekiel 18, 23 and 32. Ezekiel 18, chapter, verse 23. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel. It's going the wrong way, no wonder. Isaiah. Chapter 18, and you find this about 3-4 times, so I won't repeat myself. But on Isaiah, you find the same thing here as you would in Ezekiel also. Did I say Isaiah? It's brrr, you're rewinding right now, brrr, about 30 seconds, okay? Is that the worst sound of a tape? So just put that out of your mind and go back about 3 chapters to Isaiah. Now, did I say Isaiah? Good. I mean, it's good that I said something wrong, that I recognize that. Go to Ezekiel 18, Ezekiel 18. And that's, and I'm saying go back. How about going forward? Okay, you'll see this, like I said, a few times. It's not just once you'll find this attitude that God has. Ezekiel 18, verse 23. Here it says, do I have any pleasure at all that the wicked should die, says the Lord, and not that he should turn from his ways and live? Do we have any pleasure with what's going on with the Palestinian situation? And the answer is no, we have no pleasure. No pleasure at all. Now, it's not only that, there's an attitude that God says he has besides not having any pleasure. And again, you can see this in Ezekiel 33. But let's go to Hosea 11. Hosea 11 and verse 8. And this is with Israel. Hosea, Joel, Amos. So Hosea is the first of the minor prophets, and we're in chapter 11, Hosea 11 and verse 8. So notice, and I think this is one of the best scriptures to show God's attitude, because it's not that he just doesn't have pleasure. There's something else going on with God when he is looking at people dying, whether they are his called people or not. But here's Ephraim and Israel. Now, these people aren't Church of God people. This is a nation, a physical nation that God is talking about. And he would have the same attitude for us if we deserve to die, if we, you know, were practicing the breaking of God's commandments. How can I give you up, Ephraim? How can I hand you over, Israel? How can I make you like Admah? How can I set you like Zebulun? Now, I didn't know what God was talking about when he talked about these two cities. How many of you know off the top of your head? I didn't. I had to look it up. There were 4 cities along with Sodom and Gomorrah that suffered the same consequence. And the 2 other cities besides Sodom and Gomorrah was Admah and Zeboim. They also had fire come down from heaven and destroy them. So God says, well, how can I completely destroy you? And then God says, my heart churns within me. It's just that, not that he has pleasure. He didn't have pleasure. But more than that, can you imagine God thinking, yeah, I really don't want to do this. I don't like this happening. Maybe I should tell Netanyahu to call it off, you know? Now, it has to follow through according to prophecy, whatever's going to happen, and I don't know the end of the matter. I know the full end of the matter, not maybe in detail, but we all do because we read the prophecies, but we don't know specifically concerning this conflict. We don't know, but we should have the same attitude. Excuse me. We should have the same attitude. My heart churns within me. My sympathy is stirred. Can we be sympathetic in what's happening? Even though it's an unrighteous nation, totally unrighteous, Arabs and all of the different religious or national definitions within the Arab world, we know, even though they hate Israel, is our sympathy stirred toward them? And the answer is, it should be. Do they deserve to die? Well, yes, they deserve to die. You can't take that away. You know, people, if they make mistakes, if they do things that are wrong, then they do deserve to die. All of those individuals who attacked over into October the 7th, into the border there of Gaza, all of those, do they deserve to die? And the answer is, yes, they do. They do. Does God take pleasure in their death? No, he does not take pleasure at all. Does he know they must? Yes, he knows they must. Absolutely. My sympathy is stirred. I will not execute the fierceness of my anger. I'm really glad that we worship a God like that. But that's the way God feels. And he, Lamentations, he says he does not willfully, I won't turn to that, but God does not willfully, in other words, his will is not to cause people to die, either directly or indirectly. So I hope all of us recognize, and I'll go to a last scripture here in Micah 6 and verse 8, and the attitude that we need to have at all times. Micah 6 and verse 8. Here God says, what shall I come to God with and bow myself before the high God? Chapter 6 and verse 6. What shall I come to God with and bow myself? Shall I come with burnt offerings and calves that are a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression? Of course not. The fruit of my body for the sin of my soul. He has shown you, O man, what is good and what he requires of us. And in all of this conflict, this is what God requires of us. To do justly, we must be righteous. To love mercy, to really love mercy, to want to be merciful. If there's any chance to be merciful, be merciful. When you can't, you can't. Absolutely can't. Because God shows that people who have sinned and that there have been kings that have been taken out very quickly by other kings and by God's prophets even. So sometimes you can't, but do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly before God. We are all raised in a very tough, hardened society. We have movies. It's hard to find a movie that is halfway decent. I think Hallmark, as far as what I see, it's pretty plain, which is good. You don't have violence in Hallmark movies. And there's other movies that are out there that have been made for Christians, nominal Christians. There are. We know that. But overall, we live in a very hardened society. My dad was a coal miner when I was born. And that's not a job where you find, you know, wimpy guys. Dad was tough. He hated people. Maybe it's too hard. He disliked people who wouldn't work. Disliked them. He became a blacksmith. It's a tough job. He did not like people who wouldn't work. He just didn't. And he had no compassion. He was a tough guy. He was a loving, gentle father. But he didn't put up with umbala. I think that's the nicest word I've ever heard to describe. He didn't put up with it at all. He was tough. And so it was, you know, they deserve it. So sad, too bad. That was kind of the society that I was raised in, and overall that the world is raised in. Or totally on the other side, and that is, oh, we can't hurt those people. There's the two ends of the matter. So I hope all of us look at what God desires of us. We understand why the world is the way it is, why what is happening in Israel is happening, why there are innocent lives that are being taken. But I hope all of us have that mercy of God, the attitude of God, and really, really love for God's kingdom to come, to take care of all of these problems.